For more information on ancient dragon Zengate and Taigen's teachings, please visit our website at www.ancientdragon.org. Our teachings are offered to the community through the generosity of our supporters. To make a donation online, please click on the link for Just Give on our website.
Good morning, everybody. To give your sheep or cow a large, spacious meadow is the way to control me. I think most of you, a lot of you probably know these words. They're from a book called Zen My Beginner's Mind by this fellow named Suzuki Roshi, through whose generosity and sincere practice, in large measure, we were able to sit here today. He was the founder of a Japanese monk who came, Japanese priest who came to San Francisco 50-some years ago and founded the San Francisco Zen Center, which is the practice institution in whose orbit we ourselves practice. So, yes, to give your sheep or cow a large, spacious meadow is the way to control him. I used to work at the University of Chicago Press as a manuscript editor. And for a while, in about 2008, they consolidated into a big building. But for a long while, we were sort of spread out, little cubbies and crannies throughout Hyde Park. And I was working in a converted warehouse on Stony Island Avenue at about 56th Street. And I'm going to tell two stories basically today, one about myself, or one in which I'm somewhat directly involved in, and one in which I'm not. And the first one, kind of a trivial story maybe in some ways, but I think interesting, and it has to do with being working at this place. Stony Island kind of dead ends into 56th Street's T-shaped intersection. And there's a place called Bret Harte Elementary School right at that juncture. And then my building was about three quarters of a block down the street. And after working there for some time, I started to notice that every afternoon at a certain time, there'd be all this honking outside the window, you know. And I couldn't see directly outside the window because it was glass blocks, but there was a little clear pane up a little higher. Anyway, so I never knew what the situation was exactly, but every day at a certain time there'd start to be this honking, and it was frankly a little annoying for me at the time. And so finally I got curious, and I put my chair up, and I looked out the window and realized what was going on. Was that school was letting out. And consequently, there would be this flurry of activities. The roads are, I won't go into detail, but it's things do not flow smoothly there. You know, one part of the intersection suddenly changes to one way, and it's narrow, and, you know, it's just not a particularly well-designed situation. And so what was happening is that school would let out, and there would be this activity of getting kids onto the school buses and crosswalk guards helping little groups of kids, you know, 6, 7, 8-year-olds, get safely across the street to meet their parents, say. And people would, you know, they could be delayed for, say, 5 minutes. And so you might get 15 or 20 cars backing up, and they're sitting there. And traffic situations, for the most part, don't bring out the most patient part of any of us. And so people would get annoyed, like, why am I sitting here? And start honking. And their response would ramify in the sense that all the people who were trying to concentrate and, you know, edit in this building down the street would also be annoyed. At least I was. But like I said, one day I sort of looked out the window And I realized, oh, this is what's going on. There's this blockage, and people are not in a position to see it. All they're in a position to see from their perspective is that they're hindered, blocked in whatever their intentions are and getting to wherever they're going. And they're impatient with that, and they start to honk. And it occurred to me that at that time that probably if any of those people, there's a little bit of projection here, I suppose, but I thought that probably if any of those people realized that the issue was getting kids, little kids, safely to where they want to go, they would probably be less impatient. And in fact, this was somewhat confirmed to me the other night when I was talking about this at Rockefeller Chapel. It turns out that one of the women who was there lives about a block from that intersection. She said when she moved there, she also noticed there would be these times and days when she would have trouble getting in and out of her building because of the traffic, and she would be bothered and didn't like the situation. But then she put it together, oh, school's getting out. And that made it different for her. And that was my thought too. It's like, well, people, you know, yeah, they want to get to wherever they're going, but if they realize what the broader situation is, they'd probably be a little more patient. And somehow, you know, having that thought, and also having the awareness that most of these drivers were not in a position to actually be able to see that, just the way things were laid out, you couldn't really see what was going on. And realizing my own propensity for irritation and frustration, particularly in traffic situations, my own annoyance dropped away. At a certain time, I would hear the honking, and it's like, oh, this is what's going on. And it was different, because there was a different view. There was a wider, slightly, in a trivial sense maybe, but a kind of a wider view. The second story I'd like to tell has to do with this guy named Ed Brown, and probably some of you have heard this story before. Some of you may have even met him or know him. He was an early student of Suzuki Roshi, when Suzuki Roshi founded the San Francisco... I keep holding up this picture because I love this picture. Suzuki Roshi had founded San Francisco Zen Center. Ed Brown was a student there. And then after a period of time, they opened Tassajara, which was the, and still is, the monastery associated with San Francisco Zen Center. And Ed Brown, apparently, some of you older people may remember, if you remember something called the Tassajara Bread Book, it was kind of a cult thing in the 70s. Still is. He was the author of that, but he was the first cook at Tassajara, and he apparently got this job, this responsibility, because he had been practicing Zen for a while, and he had 2 months' experience as cook, and so he became the tenzo, the person who runs the kitchen. And he tells this story. It's a funny story. It's interesting. You can find it. You can Google it. Just Ed Cook to see virtue, something like that. Or go to Dave Chadwick's cucumber site and read the whole thing. But, you know, partly he tells the story. So he gets in this position of responsibility where they're trying to get this monastery off the ground. He's in charge of the kitchen, in charge of getting food out, good food out, to, I don't know, just guess maybe, you know, 80 people or 100 people a couple of times a day. And, you know, everybody's fresh to the situation. Nobody knows what they're doing. They're trying to work out procedures. Lots of people are not very experienced as Zen practitioners. And apparently it wasn't going very well. And finally, he was getting exasperated. He talks about, kind of yelling at people and not being very pleasant, and sort of a degree of again, it's like, you know, the sort of ramifying sense of responding to things that don't make things any better, but sort of spread exasperation, annoyance, or whatever, as I suggested in this little story about the traffic situation at 56 in Stony. But finally, he has an opportunity to go talk to Sensei Kimoshi about it. I didn't know if it was a formal dokusan or some less formal thing, but he says, I told him all the problems I had with people not behaving the way I thought they ought to behave if they were really practicing Zen. Arriving late, taking long bathroom breaks, gossiping, being absent-minded or inattentive. Then I asked him what advice he had on how to get everyone to work with more concentration and vigor. He goes on. He seemed to listen quite carefully, as though he understood my difficulty and was entirely sympathetic. You know, parentheses. Yes, you just can't good help anymore, can you? When I finally ran out of complaints, he looked at me briefly, and then he responded. If you want to see virtue, he said, you have to have a calm mind. Ed Brown continues, that isn't what I asked you, I thought to myself, but I kept quiet. I gave it some time to turn me around. Was I going to spend my time finding fault or seeing virtue? It had never occurred to me that I wanted to spend my time seeing virtue. But my teacher's mentioning made it seem obvious. And then the story continues, and he gives some sort of interesting accounts of, you know, how things changed for him. He also says in part of the lead up to this, you know, in this phase when he was really exasperated, I realized pretty early on, what every cook realizes, that the food more or less takes care of itself. It's the people that are hard. They don't do what you want. They don't behave the way you'd like them to. And I think we can go further and say that, in fact, in general, the world doesn't always act the way we want it to. You know, we're constantly, as is sometimes said, not getting the things we want and getting plenty that we don't want in both minor and major ways, and this leads to often to a sense of dissatisfaction. So Suzuki Roshi says, if you want to see virtue, you need to have a calm mind. You know, what is this wanting to see virtue? Is it something that we want, and what exactly does it mean? I think, you know, again, this is just a guess, but when we talk about virtue in Buddhism, we're oftentimes referring to what we call the transcendent virtue, something like that, the paramitas, the bodhisattva, virtues, qualities that one cultivates and expresses if you're practicing as someone dedicated to or intent upon bringing some kind of awakening for oneself and one others. And those are oftentimes expressed as six things. There's generosity, dana, shila, ethical discipline, kshanti, or patience, toleration, forbearance, energy, meditation, wisdom, and so on. And we can see, like in a situation, like in both of these stories, that certainly generosity would come to bear, you know, even at the level of just kind of giving people, kind of giving the situation the benefit of the doubt, not responding to it, in as if it was conspiring somehow to thwart whatever little project you had in mind at the time, you know, getting up to the grocery store to, I don't know, buy your ingredients for dinner, or, you know, whatever it is. And certainly this idea of patience, toleration, forbearance. And Suzuki Roshi, in these lines, if you want to see virtue, you have to have a calm mind, seems to suggest that, one, if we buy into the proposition that we would rather see virtue to begin with, that the way to make that possible is to slow down, quiet down, calm down a little bit. And I think this calming, this quieting down, has in part putting oneself into a position to get a wider, more comprehensive view. Suzuki Roshi says, if you want to control your cow or sheep, give it a wide, spacious meadow. Maybe if you look out on the street, not from street level, but in this very sort of crude, analogical way, from slightly above and see a little bit more, maybe you can have more compassion for other people's exasperation, and maybe some of your own will dissipate. People, of course, have devised all kinds of ways to cultivate calmness, right? Settledness. But unquestionably, the one that's emphasized in Zen is this practice of Zazen that we just did. And, Zazen is many, many things. But part of it is this, one aspect of it is this calming and settling. And despite the many very good things people have devised to calm and settle, it's my view, my conviction as a practitioner, that there's really nothing better for this than this process of just sitting that we've just engaged in. In common speech, sometimes people talk about taking a step back. If you're too wrapped up in a problem, people say, well, take a step back, and from whatever problem or situation it is, and then you can see them more clearly and you can deal with them more effectively. And, so it's this, again, it's this idea of getting a wider context. And interestingly, Dogen, the 13th century monk who brought this line of Buddhist teaching that we continue here from China to Japan, says a similar thing. He describes meditation or zazen as taking a backward step. And, so I think the wisdom there is actually the same as, this thing, this kind of folk wisdom that we have, and I'm sure lots of other cultures have. But I think Dogen actually means something much more inclusive and profound. It has to do with taking the widest possible view, in the sense that it becomes no view at all, because ultimately nothing is excluded from it, and therefore one doesn't have to pick and choose what's good and bad in the context of Zazen. And as a consequence, you sort of pull back from the game of trying to control the cavorting of that little sheep or cow or monkey that we identify as our mind, as ourselves in some sense, and pull back a little bit, not turn away, but pull back and see sort of the context, the background against which it's playing. And in a way, so, it, I mean, for a long time when I heard this phrase from Suzuki Roshi, my attention was drawn to the sheep or the cow and its many interesting doings. And indeed, this is part of what we observe moment after moment in Zazen. But more importantly, at some point, maybe not objectively in the sense of making it an object of awareness, but there's a embodied sense of the wider spacious meadow in which this is all occurring. So, when we meditate, we see both. And in our sitting, talk about it as a calming down, and it is a calming down. But at any given moment of Zazen, there may be all kinds of honking going on in your mind. There may be all sorts of traffic jams happening as we spin out all this stuff. But the more we do it, the more maybe the less we identify with the particularities of those, whatever our thoughts might be, whatever that situation might be, and sort of ease into the wider, more spacious background. And that actually changes the quality of our experience. And it's actually something that can be, once we become close to it, we become familiar with it, we can take it with us. Not, so that it comes to bear not only the traffic jams and honking and noise that happens in our own minds, but when we go out into the world and people are actually honking at us and we're actually getting into situations where we're apt to not only experience certain frustrations and annoyances, but perpetuate them and spread them by responding in unskillful ways rather than just sort of saying, okay, this is the situation now. I've got to wait for the kids to get across the street. Ed Brown, in his conversation relates further about his conversation with Suzuki Roshi. When you are cooking, you're not just working on food, you're working on yourself. You're working on other people. And Ed Brown continues, well, of course, I thought that makes sense. By extension, it's not just cooking either. It's in, if we're committed to a life of practice, this life of trying to wake up ourselves and to foster the conditions of other people's awakening and contentment, joy, those kinds of things. It becomes, all of our activities. The field of practice is obviously not limited to our mats and cushions. It's both a huge arena, but it's also a very limited one, right? We live in a bigger world. In all of our situations, we can take this sort of settling into a broader view that we become acquainted with in Zazen and try to bring it with us into the wider world. And this thing of working on ourselves and working on others, I'm not really sure exactly what Suzuki Roshi meant by that practically, concretely, but I think it's probably not exactly a matter of fixing things or controlling things. As he says, the way to control the cow or the sheep is to give it lots of room. It doesn't talk about being more pushy about it. So it's not exactly trying to control things or to fix things, but it's also not controlling and fixing things. In other words, Ed Brown still has these practical problems of running a kitchen, getting people fed. People in their cars have got to get where they're going to go, where they want to go. It's not always up to us to adjudicate on the validity of whatever activities other people choose, but we can work on ourselves in the sense of trying, as I say, to have a broader, more tolerant and generous view towards the situations we mutually find ourselves in. And if we can do that, we're Suzuki Roshi says, working on other people. And maybe there's a way to, maybe that's the right preposition, but then we can think of it also as working with other people. We can think about, in any given situation, what is our response going to be? So Ed Brown, has these concrete practical issues he has to work with, but he found that he was bringing something extra. He was being kind of this obnoxious, controlling, bossy guy. And that actually did nothing. As a matter of fact, it's destructive. It was not helping the situation. So we can work with other people by not bringing that stuff with us into situations. The greed, anger, and delusion we're all subject to, if we can, through sitting and through the practice of precepts, become more familiar with its workings, even as they are unfolding, we can give them a little more space, let them be a little bit relaxed, and we can become a little bit more tolerant, for example, of our own intolerance. And through becoming more tolerant of it, I don't mean like giving into our intolerance, but seeing it for what it is, seeing how it wants to act out, and then making a more wise and skillful choice, so that in our interactions with people, we are not adding fuel to any fire, so to speak, but rather calming the situation, cooling the situation. Ourselves and to give other people the benefit of the doubt, extending the benefit of the doubt. And I think that through practice, through Zazen, it's not only that we can become more skilled at doing that, but we can become more trusting in situations. We can give the benefit of the doubt to the situation itself, so that when we're sitting in a car backed up, we can maybe trust that there's, even though we can't see it, there is a broader context, and that if we understood it, if we could see it, we would likely be able to then see past our immediate frustrations and annoyance. Here I am in my car. I want to go buy some Hostess Twinkies. What's the deal? The world is bad. People are bad. I'm going to honk my horn and swear at people. We can just sort of step back from that a little bit. Even if we can't, it's a kind of trust. It's a kind of confidence that even when we can't see it directly, even if there are times when we don't see the wide meadow that the cow is doing its thing in, that meadow is in fact there. And I think that makes a difference. And I think the practice in general, but especially Zazen, is our main, in seeing, part of what goes on is we just sort of see this endless profusion of thoughts arise and fall with each breath. And we, we've made the commitment to sit up straight and hold our hands in the mudra and attend to it without doing more. And we, through that, get a bigger view, and that's helpful. And so, since my job as a priest is to encourage you to do Zazen, I thought this morning I would point out that feature of it. And this is going to be maybe a bit of an abrupt jump, but in the same chapter that Suzuki Roshi talks about this thing about the spacious meadow comes up, he opens that with something that I think talks about this context a little bit. So I'm going to read a paragraph. And he talks about Buddha nature. Much could be said about Buddha nature, of course, but maybe part of what it means is that these things that we hold up as for ourselves as practitioners as sort of the qualities of awakening, in other words, wisdom and compassion or insight and settling, all these kinds of things, is part of what Buddha nature is, and part of, we can think about it in our Zazen, part of what that involves is becoming familiar in some sense with those, not only as qualities that individual human beings can have, but are actually maybe features of things as they are in themselves. Anyway, I'll just, even if it's an abrupt jump, I'll finish with this paragraph because it's interesting. Suzuki Roshi says, "To live in the realm of Buddha nature means to die as a small being moment after moment. When we lose our balance, we die. But at the same time, we also develop ourselves. We grow. Whatever we see is changing, losing its balance. Caught in a traffic jam, or somebody's not doing what you want. The reason everything looks beautiful is because it is out of balance, but its background is always in perfect harmony. This is how everything exists in the realm of Buddha nature, losing its balance against the background of perfect balance. So if you see things without realizing the background of Buddha nature, everything appears to be in the form of suffering. But if you understand the background of existence, you realize that suffering itself is how we live and how we extend our life." Anyway, I'll stop there. Thank you. If anybody has any responses or anything, I'd be delighted to hear them. Question?
I love that talk. Thank you so much. It couldn't come at a better time for me because my family is planning Thanksgiving sort of reunion. And there'll be 20-something people. And the last time it happened, I was like, Edgar, I was really bossy and crabby, and everything fell apart. And so I spent this morning trying to figure out how to make it different this time. And the words that I came up with were goodwill. It's like if we all come there with goodwill, hoping, you know, to do our part in making it what we all want it to be, then maybe it will be better in this time. But this man needed to ruin these 6,000 every morning. I don't think they'll do that. Anyway, thank you so much. I'll think about it tomorrow.
Yeah.
Crabby is not the solution. Cracking the whip is not the solution.
Yeah, goodwill. Somewhere I don't see it here, but in the story by Ed Brown, he talks about, like, you know, when he sort of stepped back a little bit, he really, you know, he realized that people's intentions, you know, were basically good. You know, they weren't bad. You know, they were doing the best in, you know, this limited way as beginning students, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And yeah, it helps. David.
I have two comments of them. Mm-hmm. When I'm reminded that I knew a Bay Area psychologist by the name of John Enrich, who wrote a book called Enlightening the Shout.
And how, what's it called?
Enlightening the Shout. Mm-hmm. And how it came to him when he was working with Fritz Perls, and Fritz Perls said, the whole purpose of this is so you wake up from the dream, you realize that Fritz was talking about really enlightened in a Western sense, not a Buddhist sense, but in a Western sense. And his famous line is that loneliness is being alone plus bullshit. And that when you're alone reading a book, you're perfectly fine. When you're alone writing something or listening to a piece of music, you're fine. The time when you're loneliness is the same situation. Our mindset has changed. The situation is the same. We're still alone. What's changed is the baggage we bring with us. Mm. And that is a matter of being attention and paying attention to what baggage are we bringing up. Like if you bump into somebody in a grocery store and you spill your groceries and they spill theirs and you go, and then you see a person is blind, mm-hmm. What's going to happen? And all of a sudden your whole mindset changes. And for me personally, here at Zenda, during the station, during our 3-day or 1-day practices, I worked as assistant Tenzo in helping in the cooking. And I could look at it as either, oh, I got to chop all this stuff, I got to make sure I don't cut your fingers, and all that. Or what I changed for me is that I think that every cut I'm doing is a gift. The people who are sitting, everything that I do is a gift to the people. And I even do the Beatles mantra of all you need is love while I'm chopping. And it's no longer a chore. And the time flies by. And I just get this feeling of warmth. And this story about this man who's the head cook, I could just see it that if you. But when I bring it, I could so easily bring the negative to it. But by purposely choosing the positive, it makes it a whole different realm.
Thank you.
So thank you.
That was very thoughtful. Thank you. Useful to me personally in terms of recognizing that you're in a bigger field sometimes, you know, when you get very focused in on things. And from another perspective, you know, I was thinking sometimes people are in a position of leadership and they have things to get done. And, you know, so it raises that issue of how do you do it? What else do you do besides being cross with people? And I heard somebody talking about sports psychology recently, that there's a coach, which one, who makes a tape of what was done right in a game, and that's what he goes over with his team afterwards. And I was talking with a sports psychologist I know about this, and she said, yeah, because if instead, after a game, you talk about everything that went wrong, what people go forward with is, how do I avoid doing that wrong thing? So rather than thinking about what is working right and how do I continue to move in that direction, you're more focused on how do I avoid doing that wrong thing. It's a, you know, so it's like, it also impacts thinking about the impact we have on the other person in terms of how they're trying to lead them. Is a part of this. It was very helpful to think about.
That's very good. My name is Mark. This is the first time I'm here. I was thinking about the Suzuki quote you read at the end there about everything being kind of losing its balance against the background of perfect balance. And it reminded me of one of the senior students at the Zen Center I usually practice at, Greg Plainsunner, always says in his introductory statements or introductory workshops, which is that he gives the example of the ocean as one thing, but there's these separate waves that are hitting the shore all the time, and that, you know, we can say that people think that they're a separate wave, but we all come from the same ocean. The ocean is always there. So that the waves are kind of out of balance, but the ocean is this perfect source. Mm-hmm. Just made me think of that. Thank you.
Thank you.
My name is Glenn.
Glenn?
Yeah.
Nice to meet you.
In response to what he said, yes, I heard that same quote, the waves crashing against the shore, and you go, oh no, you okay. Know. We're going to die, we're crashing. And then the second wave says, no, look, you're part of this whole ocean.
Mm-hmm.
It's not the end, you're still part of something. And as for your talk, it's what we bring to a situation is pretty much summing up, I think, what you were saying, like our predispositions. What we bring to the situation, the anger, you know, the oh, but not seeing the whole thing.
Yeah. Yes.
And you know, if we stepped back and got a wider view of it, we can negate our, you know, the negativity that we bring to a situation.
Yes, thank you.
Thank you.